Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you again for joining us for this latest edition of the BDS Monitor, actually our first conference call of the new academic year. And so I'd like to welcome you all to our call. This morning, we have the privilege and opportunity again to talk to the editor of our BDS Monitor, Alex Jaffe. Be talking to us about the upcoming BDS Monitor and, of course, the latest trends and movements that have been happening as a result of the movement at large. We will touch a little bit if there needs to be discussions about the latest impact of the Israeli elections and, of course, what has happened over the summer and what we're seeing going forward globally and, of course, domestically. Allow me to say a few housekeeping issues, as always, just to remind everybody how the format works. Those of you who are logged in on phone or via the computer, you have an icon of a hand. Should you have a question, obviously we encourage as many questions as possible, please click on that icon and I will be able to unmute you, will be able to ask your questions. You also will have the opportunity, if you choose to, write in your questions that will come in to me through the system itself. As always, if there are questions after our conversation today, and as always, you can always email us at bdsmonitor, one word, bdsmonitor@spme.org, and we will always respond in a timely fashion. I will repeat those housekeeping rules or guidelines after Alex is done. But without further ado, Alex, yours. And good morning and welcome.
Well, hi, everybody. Thanks for joining us. Hope everybody is well and had a relaxing summer far away from all of this kind of trouble. And what I want to do is just review a little bit about where I think we are and make some, you know, sketch out the situation. It's very early in the academic year, obviously, so there's not a tremendous amount that's going on campuses yet, but in other parts of academia, things are beginning to move a bit. I think the place to start is probably with the Israeli elections, and that's why we decided to have this call this week, right after the elections. Now, I want to just caution that as with American politics, SPME can't take a position with respect to Israeli politics and supporting any candidates or parties. At this point, it really goes beyond that because I really have no idea, like everyone, of who's won the election in effect and what the results are going to be in terms of coalitions or, God forbid, another election someplace down the line. So all of these things, as I'm sure you all know, are very, very much in flux. I haven't looked at the numbers in over an hour, so I can't really say exactly what's going on. But I think the most important issue with respect to BDS and with respect to, let's call it, you know, the foreign relations of Israel as a whole, is that that much opposition specifically from the BDS movement and from its some of its figureheads has been directed at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, and this is longstanding, and the fact or the prospect that the Netanyahu era is over. The big question will be whether this has any kind of impact on on BDS and on criticism of Israel generally. Netanyahu is widely castigated, wrongly, rightly, what have you, by observers, most of whom are not terribly well informed about Israeli politics, as a right-wing figure, and even worse, as a demonic figure. And I don't know that this is going to really change. And I'll cite one, I think, small but telling piece of evidence, and that was social media postings a day or so ago from the leading BDS group, American BDS group, If Not Now, which responded to the ambiguity of the election results by saying, maybe Netanyahu, maybe Netanyahu is out, but the real problem is still the occupation of millions of Palestinians by Israel. And If Not Now, which supports the so-called right of return and regards pretty much all aspects of Israel as being illegitimate and right-wing by definition, I think is beginning to shift its position a little bit away from demonizing Netanyahu specifically as the cause of their anti-Israel animus and by implication. Everybody else's anti-Semitism, to a more broadly based and I think in a sense inadvertently honest assessment of the problem as being Israel's existence. So we'll see. Again, it's too early to really say how other parts of the BDS movement are going to respond. You could dig down into statements from various branches of Students for Justice in Palestine and various BDS supporters, either in the strong mode of BDS or in the lighter mode of BDS, Jewish and non-Jewish critics alike. But we'll see. My feeling is that because there is no overtly left-wing government, and there's no path for an overtly left-wing government to emerge in Israel. The policy differences between Netanyahu and Gantz are not huge, let's say. the rhetorical stances are quite different, but policies as I understand them aren't so different. But because there's no left-wing alternative that would be open to criticisms of the occupation, so-called, and that would be receptive to BDS as a strategy, as a movement, that the criticism will really continue and that not a whole lot will change. And there'll be a certain amount of should Netanyahu not become prime minister, there'll be a certain amount of gloating and ding-dong, the witch is dead sort of talk. But then they'll turn around in the next tweet or Facebook posting and say the real problem is Israel and its policies. So we'll see. It'll be very interesting and I think rather depressing going forwards. So that said, let me just keep an eye on the time here. Let me just do a little bit of a roundup of some of the more important BDS developments of the last few days, the last couple of weeks. And I think the most important, and the most interesting, and the most telling has been all the shenanigans of the last two or three days connected with March. And as we all know, and I think painfully aware, the Women's March gained a tremendous amount of notoriety in the last year, in particular as it's as the virulent anti-Zionism and underlying anti-Semitism of its core organizers and many of its local branches began to be manifest. And these come, I think, directly from the top. Linda Sarsour, Tamika Mallory, Bob Bland, and some of the others. All sorts of financial chicanery has been reported. So in any case, the terms of the three prime suspects, let's call them, were up, and they were replaced by a couple of other names that we are unfortunately familiar with. Primary among them is Zahra Bilou, a lawyer who is a leading figure at the San Francisco branch of CARE, and Samia Asad and Charlene Crothers, who are far left-wing activists, BDS supporters, connected with a variety of groups, Dream Defenders, Black Youth, something I'm blanking out. It's connected to Black Lives Matter. If anything, these three characters, Bilou in particular, are far worse, far more explicit in their antipathy towards Israel and Jews than the original organizers were. When this was pointed out, in a sudden, unexpected turn of events, Bilou was voted off of the board this morning. So they couldn't take the pressure, but the other ones are still on the board. So I think the lesson here is that once again, as always, as will always be the case, that eternal vigilance is necessary, and making a stink is absolutely necessary, and that scrutiny of astroturfed groups, pressure groups like the Women's March, like Black Lives Matter, like Dream Defenders, all of which are interconnected, all of which can be traced back in terms of their organizations and personnel and funding and training to a series of organizations that were set up in order to astroturf the progressive movement, is absolutely necessary. And that sometimes you can claim, well, in Bilou's case, she's the victim, of course. She's claiming that she's the victim. So you can make a certain amount of stink and make a dent. Now, the other, the flip side of this is when you don't, when vigilance, it comes too late, and when pushback isn't made. And we have in Britain a very good example of how these kinds of anti-Semitic BDS supporting rabidly anti-Zionist individuals and narratives become entrenched within various institutions. So the Trade Union Council, which represents over 50 unions, 5.4 million members. The leading union umbrella organization voted last week to renew its call for Israel boycotts and to also to partner with the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, which is Britain's leading and really most virulently anti-Semitic BDS organization. And this comes at the same time as the Labour Party is preparing to have its annual conference. And parallel with these conferences are a variety of so-called fringe events, which are held by labor-aligned groups. And to one of them, Omar Barghouti, a founder of the Palestine Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, has been invited. Now, I don't, there's not enough time to go through all the details about the labor crisis. The anti-Semitism crisis in labor began on campus with labor-aligned clubs, which were supporting BDS. And as this was exposed, it created a shockwave through British left-wing politics, as it became clear that a small cadre, relatively small cadre of socialist individuals in supporting Jeremy Corbyn had in effect taken over the party from within. And as part of this process, they had astroturfed a wide variety of organizations, including Jewish organizations. A Jewish organization, Jewish Voice for Labor, which was designed to deflect criticism about the anti-Semitism of everybody else. And I think this is precisely what's been happening in progressive politics in American society. And this has penetrated into the leftmost features of the Democratic Party, with characters like Ilhan Omar, who went on, I think it was Face the Nation last week, rather incoherently claiming that BDS was a legitimate pressure device in order to further the goal of a two-state solution, as she continued to rail against the possibility of Netanyahu being reelected. So, and this, of course, is not what BDS is about. BDS is about, among other things, the right of return, so-called, and the dissolution, destruction of Israel. So there are, and Linda Sarsour figures into this as well, because she is, she went on record last week, I think, saying that she would love to see Bernie Sanders elected as the first Jewish president of the United States. And Sanders himself, who is not a supporter of BDS as a movement, has gone on record supporting the right of individuals to boycott Israel, and has also made big efforts in outreach towards BDS supporters, most recently appearing at the Islamic Society of North America conference, which is a leading American Muslim Brotherhood BDS supporting organization. So it's here, and it's percolating through the system, and it's all very unfortunate. But on the other hand, I think, and again, I don't wish to sound as if I'm endorsing any, but it's useful to point out that if polls are to be believed, and if comments from, let's call them mainstream Democrats, are to believe, the most viable Democratic candidate is Joe Biden, who is an old school Democrat with respect to Israel, with respect to his relations with the Jewish community. He's not fond of Netanyahu, from what I can tell, but he certainly hasn't signed on to any manifestos or employ BDS supporters in the manner of Elizabeth Warren, or taken overt support from Linda Sarsour and her ilk. So all of which is to say that BDS is now entrenched fully as a part of American politics, local politics, presidential politics, congressional politics. And it's going to stay there. And if Democrats and Republicans and anybody who cares about American politics do not wish this country to go the way of labor and Britain, then we must be mindful of the situation and push back whenever possible. Now, with respect to pushback, I'll point to a couple of things, because I think there are signs on the margins, signs in different places within American cultural politics broadly that there is pushback. So in direct terms, the American Political Science Association rejected a BDS resolution early in the month from one of its far left sections, groupsicles, you might say. That's a positive, and after a great deal of last minute organizing on the part of various BDS opponents. So that's an internal sign. An external sign is the fact that the Department of Education recently criticized Duke University and University of North Carolina for holding an anti-Israel event back in the spring about Gaza, at which BDS supporting rapper or whatever he was featured, saying that this was a misuse of funds from Title VI. Now, Title VI of the International Higher Education Act of 1965, or go to a variety of Middle East centers, and are designed to enhance the teaching of foreign languages with an eye towards improving American national security and economic sustainability. And supporting BDS doesn't really fit into that. And as we know, as I'm sure all of you know, Title VI has been basically a gigantic 50-year slush fund for the promotion of Islamist narratives within colleges and universities, aimed at not only local environment, but through outreach and educational programs aimed at K-12 programs. Another report from a research center demonstrated that in, I think it was the last 10 years, over a billion dollars had been spent by Arab Muslim states, above all Qatar and Saudi Arabia, earmarked for American colleges and universities. And this has, as many of us know, as many of us have been talking about for 10, 15, 20 years, this has directly shaped pedagogy at American colleges and universities in terms of officially sanctioned anti-Israel bias, officially sanctioned anti-Christian and anti-Jewish bias, and elevation of an Islamist narrative within these institutions. So there's pushback from a variety of sources. And as society becomes, the media and everybody becomes more aware of, in particular, the negative role that Qatar plays in Washington and as a whole, I think there's more awareness. And this is yet another area where you could say there's been a little bit of pushback, both from the administration and culturally, politically. But let me conclude by pointing to a couple of other areas. And this is what I've been thinking about, trying to write about a little bit, about self-correction. And what I'm beginning to see, and I hope that this is not wishful thinking, is that there are, in different areas, the beginnings of a reaction against the hectoring and badgering that prevails in much of political and cultural discourse, and against cancel culture, as it's called, the idea that wrongthink can demands that an individual be canceled, lose their jobs, lose their platforms, lose their livelihoods, and so called, which of course is fundamentally what BDS is about. It's very much been this idea that Israel and its supporters need to be canceled, and but so you know, I'm looking around and I'm seeing it really just in the last, especially in the last month, a variety of cultural commentators who are pushing back in different spheres. So you have two comedy specials on Netflix now, Dave Chappelle and Bill Burr, which are anti-PC, and people have, a certain small subset of people have become hysterical about it because they make fun of victim culture and so on. And these are immensely popular. There was an article in the Atlantic magazine, George Packers, a staff writer who sends his kid to schools in public schools in New York City, who's complaining, and who very much is a person of the left, who's complaining and sort of wringing his hands a bit about the complete and total politicization of the primary and secondary education system, public education systems in the city. You have Bill Maher, the nighttime comedian host, talk show host guy, who has very, very negative things to say about BDS. You have Andrew Sullivan, who's kind of a gadfly, former editor of the New Republic, writing in New York Magazine now about the New York Times and its absolute politicization of American history with its 1619 project, which basically recasts all of American history as original sin on the basis of slavery. Now, all of this said, I don't think that these are going to have much impact on institutions just yet. But I think these are inklings of self-doubt and self-correction among the people who are supposed to be reliably, who are supposed to be reliably supporting particular kinds of narratives about that are politically correct. And as we are all aware, BDS very much and Israel very much fit into these narratives. And that is very much a part of upper middle class, coastal respectability, increasingly, to be anti-Israel within particular religious denominations, Jewish and Christian, and so on, and within certain sectors of society. The fact that these don't represent a majority of people has never really been the issue. These are influential sectors of society. But I think something's changing. And I can't quantify it. And I think we'll be having a discussion again next month via a webinar to talk about a whole bunch of new bad things that have gone down in October. And in November, at the beginning of November, the National Students for Justice in Palestine conference is going to be held at the University of Minnesota. And protests against that are going to be met with all sorts of counter protests about shutting down free speech and so on and so on. But I think people have to think about where they want to position themselves. And this is a very, and let me, I'll just conclude with that. This is a very difficult issue because to position yourself on certain issues like BDS, like Israel, and increasingly about the position of American Jews in this society is to be forced to make certain kinds of more broad political choices. It's not a smorgasbord, but if you're where you can pick and choose, and I believe this on this issue and that on that issue. But if you're an opponent of BDS, you're very much, and have been for some time, very much cast as a right-wing conservative, and this is not correct. This is not where all of the opposition to BDS comes from, culturally or politically. And breaking down these kinds of barriers is something that has begun to occur as critics of the Women's March from within have noted, that people who are reliably on the left have protested at the anti-Semitism and anti-Zionism of their leaders, their so-called leaders, putative leaders. And this kind of break away from herd thinking, I think, is very important, not only for Israel, not only for dealing with BDS, but more broadly, culturally, politically. And so that's a good place to leave it. And so I'm a teeny, teeny, tiny bit hopeful. The sun is out today. So I choose to be hopeful, and I'll run with that. So having said that, let's take some questions about what's Great. Going on.
Thank you, Alex. We appreciate that as always. So the floor is now open. Again, to recap, anybody who has a question, of course, please click on the hand icon, and I'll be able to unmute you. You'll be able to answer your question. You'll be able to ask your question. As we wait for people to ask their questions. So as a segue, Alex, to your point about the issue of this canceled culture and this kind of flicker of self-correctness that you're pointing to, that you're seeing in American society, what do you see, or how do you see, obviously the potential of Benny Gantz getting becoming prime minister, and the self-correctness, as you pointed out, when it comes to the American Jewish community in Israel? Obviously, the Netanyahu has been a good, has been a focal target for the advocates of the boycott movement, and obviously within left-wing circles, including the American Jewish left, he too has been the source of agitation and frustration, and the a walking target. Is there an element of self-correctness vis-a-vis American in Israel as a result of the outcome, or we continue to see a same old same, given the fact that, as you pointed out correctly, really there is no left in Israel, and policy-wise there's not going to be much difference between any Gantz government or a Benjamin Netanyahu government?
Well, I think there, I think in a broad sense there's an analogy. Again, I don't want to make it sound like I'm on one side or another for any of these candidates. I think that from what I can tell, and I should add, I really found the whole idea of a second election rather, and the process, fatiguing, unnecessary, rather disgusting. I checked out to a large extent. But I don't think that anybody can deny that there was a good deal of overshoot on the part of Netanyahu and Likud, rhetorically, at the very least. And this is one of his signature moves, that at the last minute he'll pull out, an annexation plan or some new information about Iran or what have you. It wasn't really an annexation plan as such, but regardless, in order to motivate his supporters. But it was a very negative it was a very negative campaign. And you have, what's his name, the head of the Arab List, saying it was such a negative campaign that it brought out all of Israeli Arabs to vote against him. And I think in that sense, that overshoot is motivating people all over the place to say enough, has a certain kind of heuristic value. But I think this, and I think in a sense the same thing is happening here. You have, and in this respect, the Democratic presidential candidates' debates have been very illuminating, and there's been a lot of, you know, they're telling you what they're going to cancel. Yeah. And the reaction against that has been quite vocal, that there are a lot of people who do like their health insurance, and there are a lot of people who do like to own firearms, and so on and so on and so on. Again, you know, the validity, the morality, the wisdom of any of those viewpoints on either side is not the issue here. It's the nature of the rhetoric and the nature of the response to the rhetoric. And I think people are getting fed up and being told that you're bad because you're making jokes is very irritating. And I can't tell you how many things I've read in the last couple of weeks, you know, deeply analyzing the social role of comedians in American and world society, and whether it's really to make people laugh or make people think, and you know, somehow comedians have to transcend laughter and punching up and punching down. I think it's gotten to the point where people don't want to be hectored and badgered so much.
Right, it's down to the point of the absurd. And I think one of the first, you know, on that note that got into it was no other than Jerry Seinfeld, who a few years back made a comment that he would not speak on American college campus as a result of the fact that he is not PC enough to even be accepted within those circles.
Right. And so I think this is where we are now. Is it a leading indicator of broader kinds of trends in American society where everyone will kind of take a deep breath and calm down and the anger will recede? Not yet, I don't think. And I think institutions, particularly universities and corporations, are lagging indicators that they will be the last people to get the message that broader society as a whole wants everybody to just, you know, calm down. Yeah. But and that creates a disconnect between institutions and organizations and society as a whole, such as we can measure it. We can measure it in a sense very precisely. If you go to the Rotten Tomato meter and you look at how many critics approve of Dave Chappelle, it's very low. And how many recommendations it has, it's enormous. So there is a there is a disconnect. So so why don't we take
we have a few questions. Why don't we you know, let people assume. We have a few that have written in, and let's take Sasha's question here. Sasha, can you hear us?
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead.
Awesome. So first of all, thank you for having this session. It's been really helpful. Quick question for you. You talked a little bit about Bill Maher and some of the left people on the left kind of moving away from BDS and talking about like political correctness, culture, and all that jazz. Do you think that this is a result of kind of some of the, a lot of the left moving further left, that these guys who have always been kind of, you know, who consider themselves left have kind of been pushed more towards the middle? And if, you know, regardless of the case, what do you think that we as a Jewish community, as a pro-Israel community, can kind of do to maybe attract more of that moderate left? Thank you.
Thank you. Alex?
It's a very good question. And it's, you know, it's one of these questions where it's a little difficult for me to answer because, you know, I don't think of myself as part of any sort of political stance, or that's, which is neither here nor there. I think there, for one thing, there are generational tensions being played out.
Okay.
I think that certain older generations, and I don't know how old is, you know, baby boomers such as myself don't really count, but generations X, Y, Z, whatever we're up to now, I think that there are various kinds of internal dynamics, and it's that need to be looked at a little more closely. There are socioeconomic and geographical tensions and dynamics that are being played out. It's really quite undeniable that you know, there are peculiar demographic issues associated with BDS and anti-Israel bias. It's a coastal thing. It's a college town thing. It's associated with particular communities, which give it a geography,
mm-hmm.
and which have electoral, very much have electoral implications.
Mm-hmm.
But so that's why you find it in some places, but not others. It has religious dimensions that, you know, certain Protestant denominations, which have, you know, less intensely religious but far more intensely progressive standpoints, are much more into it than you know, evangelicals or other kinds of fundamentalist so-called denominations. But what's pushing people on the left? I think there's a certain amount of being fed up. I don't know that I can characterize it in any more detail than that. Look, you know, when you look at, and there's a, you know, there's a broader problem, and that is that, you know, once upon a time there were three TV networks and PBS, and everybody got the same material and the same message. Now there are, you know, 50 million networks and 100 billion websites, and narrow casting to very, very finely split audiences is a thing. And with that has been the rise of infotainment, that and you know, this kind of peculiar role of the late night talk show as not an entertainer to make people laugh and to introduce bands and their new albums, but to somehow promote political positions. And so is that the left today? I don't really know. How influential is that? How many people watch Trevor Noah, or Saturday Night Live? Well, and the Saturday Night Live is another good example, actually. this past week. They hired some guy. They found that he had tweeted some obnoxious stuff years ago. They fired him, then they rehired him. I think there's a growing fear broadly of A, being found out that you've been a jerk in the past, as many, if not most of us have been, but also there's a frustration with having to be held accountable for every single word that has ever been uttered in the history of your life. And influencing people, I think, should be done on that basis. Let's say on the basis of saying, this harsh and intolerant culture that we have created is dysfunctional for everybody. And the severity of the criticism and the bitterness of the rhetoric, and pointing out that Israel has been a leading and one of the first really issues to create this kind of bitterness. Stepping back from this and looking at issues more dispassionately on the other hand, but sympathetically on the one hand, is a good thing. And also having the bravery for people to step into the lion's den. I mean, hats off to Barry Weiss, who writes about these things in the papers or goes on Bill Maher and then gets yelled at. I had the experience this week. I made some kind of comment on Twitter in response to something that Barry said, and the amount of just sheer hatred that was directed towards me and her was really quite shocking. And the first step is to get away from that kind of mentality, where everybody has to be so bitter, and this is something that I think people who oppose BDS have to do also, not respond with the same tone, but respond with specificity, with and detail, with passion, but not with the same anger.
But you're seeing that. I mean,
I'm stop me here. I'm just going.
No, on. I think that was a great answer. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sasha. Appreciate the question. Let's move on here. And I think that obviously there's a lot to discuss on these matters. And obviously, in the age of identity politics, that we have, many of us have been discussing and living in, trying to talk about these issues, everything has been boiled down to these one-liners. It doesn't afford any kind of conversation, discourse, details that you were mentioning, Alex. I mean, so people are left with very minimal information, very minimal desire to even actually want to explore any issue before they make any conclusions or decisions about where they are.
I think that's very much the case. I read a piece this week, I forget where it was, by a professor of American history. His name is Will McClay. And he was talking about the New York Times 1619 project. It's been a long time since I've been in a classroom, but he noted that when he goes into his classroom and talks about slavery, students are shocked and taken aback and in disbelief when they find out that slavery has been basically the norm in all societies around the world until about 100 years ago, 200 years ago, and that that it's not somehow unique to America, and that it still goes on today in a number of places, particularly in Africa and the Middle East. So the amount the amount of ignorance on the part of everybody, but especially younger people who have been treated badly by the educational system and by the infotainment system, by the Daily Show as a source of information, and by all these other kinds of all these other kinds of platforms which have substituted bits and pieces of skewed information and an immense amount of snark and bitterness. And then when they go to university, in the best case, they will be disabused of these notions and have a systematic framework provided to them. At worst, they will find out things that they don't want to know, and they'll be shocked and appalled and reject it because it doesn't somehow comport with their lived experience. So again, for whatever my positive vibes are on a nice sunny day here on the East Coast, we have not seen the bottom yet. The institutions haven't shown inclinations towards self-correction yet. Individuals have, and individuals, of course, lead the way. They set the tone, and and again, apropos Sasha's, setting the right tone is important. Being positive but firm. Being well-informed, but sympathetic. And this doesn't mean being a squish. This doesn't mean rolling over and saying, well, you have your side, I have my side. No. There are truths in the world, mostly with a small t, not a large t. But being able to listen is key, because if nothing else, listening is how you calibrate your own response instead of just throwing rocks at one another. And we're still very much in a position broadly culturally where people don't listen to one another, and getting past that is absolutely vital. So
great, thank you. I just want to be cognizant of the time. We have three questions that people have asked.
Oh, so let's go.
So let me, Ralph, let me read his questions that were sent in. Question by Ralph was, are we able to direct efforts to expose and hopefully minimize funding that are the roots of BDS? It appears we are reactionary, treating all these symptoms. That's question number one. Steve's question, it relates to the BDS funding. He talks about the fact, and I'll read Steve's question here, does the BDS support the destruction of Israel similar to the Hamas charter? And Barry's question, and it relates to that, of course, is how anti-Semitic in the traditional sense is BDS? So I think that, you could probably combine those three questions into one answer.
Okay, well, so let me address the funding issues. I think, and speaking as someone who's done a considerable amount of work on the funding questions, I think you have to break it down in a number of ways. Specifically, there's funding directed at BDS organizations. And there's a lot of ins and outs here. There are lots of far left foundations and individual donors. There's lots of blank spots because funds are donated anonymously or through donor designated funds, through investment vehicles that allow you to donate money. And then there's the broader environment, which create the broader funding situation, which creates the environment in which BDS has managed to flourish. And that's a question of Saudi and Qatari and Turkish money, billions and billions of dollars over the last 40 years, 50 years, which have fundamentally reshaped American colleges and universities. And, you know, people who've tuned into the to our broadcasts before have heard me say very negative things about colleges and universities and how they will basically do anything for a dollar. And this is a very significant issue that excuse me, that there's very little critical judgment, and this foreign money, which has people become more aware of recently, has been spread far and wide. The example I always cite is the $25 or so million given to the University of Arkansas for the King Fahd Center for Middle East Studies. And if you don't think that makes a difference in terms of the narratives that come out of the institution, the types of courses that get taught at the institution, and with their emphases, with their biases, and with the type of people who take those courses, you know, this is how you know, the ground has been tilled for decades for BDS. So it's not simply the organizations themselves, many of which are, you know, kind of run on the cheap. And more recently, you know, these are part of integrated AstroTurf kinds of efforts run by organizations which create lots of so-called grassroots groups. So the group Never Again Action was created by a bunch of people from If Not Now, and they all got training from something called the INE Institute, and funding from some other group. And this is the same group that has trained and helped fund and facilitate Black Lives Matter and Dream Defenders and lots of other groups. So it's almost nothing is spontaneous. Almost nothing is as it seems. Nothing comes up from below. And, you know, again, very much like the momentum movement which took over the British Labour Party, there are groups, there are individuals, there are forces, there's money behind it which seek to create a unified position on the left in the progressive movement, which, among other things, and you know, one of the leading issues that many of them seem to agree about is that Israel is uniquely bad, and people who support it are uniquely bad. So, you know, with regard to the question about the anti-Semitism of the BDS movement, maybe this is a good place to stop. I think that, again, there are hard versions and there are soft versions. There are oblique statements and there are overt statements. At the end of the day, if one supports the so-called Palestinian right of return, which denies Israel the right to exist and for Jews to have any kind of political sovereignty in their own state, I think that that's fundamentally anti-Semitic, because it denies one particular ethno-religious group rights that are otherwise theoretically available to everyone else in the world. Now, if you take the position, as some people do, as a few people do, that all ethno-religious states are illegitimate, and that, or that all nationalism is somehow illegitimate, the idea that all nations which have boundaries, which have internal organizing concepts, these are somehow illegitimate. Well, then that's another thing. I think that that's ridiculous. I think it's incoherent, but at least it's consistent with it would be consistent with one's opposition specifically to Israel. But that's not usually the case. Usually the case is that Israel is original sin, and that Israel has a unique evil in the world, and that this is, it's what you do with that idea, and how you view the articulation of that idea with everything else about Jewish power, Jewish influence, Jewish money, Jewish populations, and so on. And that's where the shape, the individual shape of anti-Semitism is expressed. And different people say it differently. Different groups say it differently. So let me stop there. I think that's a good place to stop. So it's 1 o'clock and everybody should go have some lunch.
Thank you very much, Alex, as always. And obviously, we are always grateful for trying to unpack all these complicated issues and the things that we need to be tackling. And obviously, we're not done discussing or tackling these topics. And we appreciate everybody joining us this afternoon. And we hope you join us again for our next call. I'd like to take the opportunity, a week before the Jewish High Holidays, to wish all of our Jewish listeners a happy and healthy new year. And I want to thank Alex, as always, for taking the time to talk to us. Alex, you want to make a point?
I wanted to mention the possibility or the prospect of additional webinars dealing with the special issue of Israel Studies.
Yes. So many of our listeners might remember that we spoke a little bit about the special edition of the Israel Studies volume Word Crimes that was devoted to dealing with the lexicon that has hijacked many of the issues that we're discussing. We have invited many of the authors of that volume to share their thoughts about their specific chapters, and so we're waiting to hear back from all of them, and once we have a list of confirmations, we will also promote that as well. So in addition to our regular calls, we will also have calls devoted by the authors, and of course, as always, guest speakers that we will hope to include in this year's series of calls and conversations. So, just FYI to everybody, and be on the lookout for the notices about those calls. So again, I want to thank everybody for joining us. I want to wish all our Jewish listeners a happy and healthy new year. I want to thank Alex again, and to be continued as always. And again, please do not be strangers. Feel free to email us if there are any questions along the way at our email, bdsmonitor@spme.org. And we look forward to continuing the conversation. Alex, any final words?
No, just everybody have a good week, have a good weekend, have a good holiday to those who are celebrating, and we'll see you all in a month or so, I hope.
Not sooner. All right, well, thank you so much. Not sooner.
Correct.
All right, take care, everybody, and have a good day and a happy and healthy for everybody. Take care.
Very good.